Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon is Paul Olson. Today's session number is 2004 and is titled Great Stories You Need to Know, Radical Faith and the Church's Vision of Stories. Let's listen in.
Are you the roller man?
No.
Okay, yeah, I understand.
You can say execute me.
Execute the recording, please. And then after you've done that, execute the recorder, the one in this room. Hi, my name's Paul Olson, and this is a session on African-American literature entitled Church, Race, and God. And not to pick any broad topic or anything. I'd like to start with a story that, with apologies to my wife, because she's heard it. Every speech I've ever given, I think I've told this story. When I was, a couple years ago, I had a student who was I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, I had a student who was flunking out. And I'm what I've always at least felt, a student advocate, and I'm going to help a student out in the jam. And I said, come, he had my class, and if he could get a C in that class, he could kind of stay in. And so I said, I'll give you the test the night ahead of time so you can study exactly what the questions are, and you come in and you'll know what they're going to be. And the first question is, how many days in the week begin with T? He fell a bit of this. Okay. The second one was, how many seconds in a year? And the third question was, how many D's in Dixie? You know, it's obvious I'm a student advocate. I'm going to try to get this kid through, and this is a pretty easy test. He comes back the next day and says, I think I'm ready. And he sat down, and I said, we're going to do this orally now, so we're going to make it as easy on you as you can. I said, how many days in the week begin with T? He said, 4. I said, oh my gosh. 4. Where do you get 4? Tuesday, Thursday, today, and tomorrow. I said, whoa, that's pretty good. I'll count that. That's creative thinking. Second question was, how many seconds in a year? And what you're thinking, right? Is it, you know, 60 times 24, and you just get a multiplication going? And he said, 12. 12? Where? How 12? January 2nd, February 2nd, March 2nd? That's also very creative. I'll count that too. Good job. The last one, you can do it now. How many D's in Dixie? And the kid's home, right? He's going to get a C in the course. He said, I stayed up all night. I didn't get it. I said, you didn't get it. What? He said, well, I'm close. Well, close count. I said, well, let's hear. What do you mean you're close? He said, well, it's either 54 or 55. 54, 55 D's in Dixie. Where are you coming from? How do you get that? Dee, 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 dee. I counted that too. Well, I tell that story because it's fun, but also to suggest that we set up for ourselves, don't we, expected paradigms of how we think people are supposed to think, how we expect people to think. And we all had expectations for those answers, Tuesday, Thursday, and whatever the multiplied number would be, and 1D in Dixie. James Baldwin, in a wonderful book that we have in our bookstore and our library, but I must push that, we have in our bookstore called The Fire Next Time. And I'm in good company, and the company is William Styron, the great author of Sophie's Choice and Nat Turner, Confessions of Nat Turner, and Lie Down in Darkness, who agrees with me. So he must be right. I must be right. That was on purpose. That this is one of the great essays of the 20th century, that is The Fire Next Time. And in The Fire Next Time is where I'm going to take off on what we will do today as kind of an exercise and as also a kind of a listening to some episodes in some great literature. In The Fire Next Time, Baldwin says, any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. Well, the black man has functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, as an immovable pillar. And as he moves out of his place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. Can you think of concrete illustrations of that abstraction? That is, where a black person or black people have stopped being fixed stars and have stopped being immovable pillars, and they shake heaven and earth. If you were here for Gaylord Thomas's movie, Cosmic Slop, the first one. You remember that? These guys are all sitting around, and what? Name some fixed stars that are all of a sudden going to shape the universe. You don't have to do them out of that movie. For there, you can use that, but anything.
Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks. Stop being a fixed star. Stay in your seat. I mean, give up your seat to a white man and move. Great example. In that movie, I'll just remind you, you know, the fixed star was, hey, 30% of the population is buying my beer. And if you ship them off, this fictional account of the aliens are going to come and make a good deal with the United States. Give us all your black people, we'll take them away. And in exchange, we'll give you a pollution-free, debt-free, clean society and countryside. And, one guy didn't want to do that because 30% of his customers, he was a beer broker, were black, and he didn't want to do it. They were his fixed star. What else?
Martin Luther King?
For sure. A fixed star. And what does he do that you're not supposed to do? I mean, it's a great example, but what did he do? What did he direct? What did he... Huh?
Dream?
Sure. Well, yeah, dream, for one thing. There's a great illustration in Richard Wright's Black Boy, when this is autobiographical. The little kid, he's 12 years old, he goes up to a place, he's looking for some money. He's selling papers to make money, and the woman says to him, well, you're making money, and what for? What do you want to be? So I want to be a writer. Who told you that? Who said you could be a writer? You're a nigger. Why go to school past the seventh grade? I grew up near an Indian reservation where everybody in town expected those Indians to grow up and become drunks and stay on the reservation. Well, social statistics tell us that, or sociology statistics tell us, 65% of Indians on reservations are alcoholic. But that's what we expect. And if they stop becoming others, just a couple.
Next.
Chappie James.
Pardon me?
Chappie James,
how so?
First four-star general, black four-star general, was instrumental in the armed services realizing that the blacks could fly combat.
Yeah, fly.
The Tuskegee Airmen.
Yep, great example. And let's talk, okay, and you can think of more, that's easy, we'll move on though. How are heaven and earth shaken to their foundations when this stuff happens? How, your very first example, Rosa Parks, how are heaven and earth shaken to their foundations? I mean, just relive that scene. You're the white person that comes on the bus, and excuse me, sorry, I'm not your fixed star anymore. Go sit somewhere else.
You've lost power.
Oh, you've lost power, and that's a great phrase for it, that heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. And, we'll come to more, and I'm going to illustrate some with literature, and we'll keep track of them. But the title of this session is Race, the Church, and God. And I'd like to have us, and I'll be your recording secretary, list some of the ways that the church has its own reality, and it can be your church or it can be the greater church, has its own reality that, and we'll just take out black man and just think of all of the things that the reality of the church that is a fixed star and that is an immovable object. For example, we'll start out simple, and I hope it gets complex and broad. When I was a little kid, you didn't go to church unless you wore a suit. I mean, I was 6 years old, and I had a suit and in that little church. So one of the fixed stars was, and I'm being simple on purpose, name some others. I just got you started. What's acceptable, what's not acceptable?
The way of worship style.
Of course, worship style.
Lots of holy cows.
I like those. What are some of those holy cows?
Well, the kitchen is off limits for some activities, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
Or women were in the kitchen and men were doing something else. Yeah. Men were ushers or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. We saw women in the Alice Walker's. I'm not going to read this scene, but it's a wonderful scene. I encourage you to read that book, too. In Alice Walker's Color Purple, all the women who are very brave and bold and strong and big and strong physically too, as well as spiritually, act as the pallbearers for their mother. And the whole church looks straight ahead, acting like this is not unusual. But they have stopped being a fixed star, these women, and the black women especially, in the black church, saying, wait a minute, we're not going to have women be the pallbearers in this thing. Okay, good. So there are certain women's roles, men's roles. What else?
Well, from the Lutheran church, anyways, there's the assumption that it's, well, it is largely, but there's it's just assumed to be so closely related to Northern European white people, but it's specifically Northern Europeans. It's difficult to fathom, and it always warrants at least a smirk when people hear about an African American Lutheran church in Oakland. Yeah.
So what are some of the fixed stars because we have this Northern European tradition?
Only in 19... Lena jokes.
What?
Only in Lena jokes.
Okay. My little magic marker didn't work on that. Maybe that's a purpose. Okay, Oli. What else? Jeannie, when on the worship and music committee and your struggle with the music director, Northern European, you wanted what in some of the worship services? This is a quiz.
Well, I was just going to say, the old staid hymns were the only things that you could sing. They're the only things that are sort of acceptable to God if you were a Northern European Lutheran.
And how many years ago was that? Not very many. Let's sing some other hymns here. And my gosh, Bach and Beethoven, that's it.
And could we use guitars or something? Oh, no, you have to use the organ.
The organ.
You
know. So we have that. Organ. Good.
People are pasty wine.
White people. And now we're getting into things that... really, maybe you should go somewhere else. We're not that kind of church. Sorry, we don't... You know, if you want that kind of music, go down the hill. And it's always down the hill, too, at least in the River Valley.
Acceptance of gays and lesbians.
For sure.
Yeah. Open communion.
What?
Communion. I'll try another one. I think, you know, if you write, that's the key I've learned, is to write slowly. Mm-hmm.
It'll be hard for you.
Communion. We met a friend a couple years ago that grew up in the Missouri Synod and couldn't shake the idea that she had to prepare her soul and her goodness to be able to take communion. Someday she just said, I'm not worthy of this tradition.
The frequency also.
Frequency of communion, big battle, isn't it, in churches? We have it every Sunday at our church, and some people think, what? You can go away, you can do that.
We become Catholic after all.
Yeah, we're Catholic, but mistakes, isn't it, alive? Yeah. Say the Minnesotans, too. Okay, some more.
Adults only for communion.
Sure. So, who takes communion? Good. What,
But is, I don't know, naturally when you're a member of a church, you don't really, unless you're a traveler, you don't get exposed to lots of different churches. But in our church, it seems like things are changing to the better with that, you know, in many of those ways.
But that's a good point. And our church is too. We now have guitars. One woman in here had to fight for those. But we got them in there.
We've got
once every 3 years. But no, it's once now. Well, let's run. Think of these things and think of your own that can apply to this. And again, listen to Baldwin. Any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. One of the things that I've seen in work with gay students is that what's most difficult for straight students in confronting them and dealing with them and living with them is that, you mean this is possible? That on this, and all kinds of psychologists tell us, on this plane of sexual identity, that we're not either here or here, but there were somewhere in the middle, and it's possible for me to have certain, that's not possible, I can't, that's an upheaval in my whole universe, and I don't want to have anything to do with these people, I don't want to have them there, that this is an acceptable, a possible way to live. And so, you know the arguments, it's biologically, it's theologically, all kinds of things come out that shake our sense of reality, so no wonder we resist. Well, then the second part, and then we'll get into some literature that will illustrate this. of Baldwin's, not the second part, but later in his essay, he has this notion, the purpose of God is to make us larger, freer, more loving. And if God cannot do this, it's time we got rid of him. That's pretty radical, isn't it? I don't think that Baldwin, despite his language elsewhere in the essay, means that this is just a concept. This is, in fact, a belief held by religious groups that this is our God. And our God is, what's the opposite of this? Easy question, a larger.
Smaller.
And so how do you illustrate a smaller God? Let's not allow so-and-so in this. Let's not allow guitars. How do we illustrate, what's the opposite of freer?
Slavery,
restricted. How do we do that?
Rules.
My dad wouldn't even think of letting me go to church without a suit. And my dad, a professional educator, if he saw me today, he would pass out. You're taught in shorts, even at Holden, you know. Okay, and then more loving. Of course, the opposite is less loving. And what has the church done? Well, I have some fun illustrations that'll set us up for some more kinds of thoughts about this. In Alice Walker's The Color Purple, a wonderful novel that says a lot about theology, about God, and about the relationship, about the images of God that have been established historically, not just in the black church, but in churches throughout America. Well, there are certain expectations. This first excerpt is not about the church. It's about expectations about someone's. It illustrates what I'm trying to use it for, is to illustrate that there's going to be an upheaval in the universe. The setup for this is Sophia is a very bold, brave, courageous, outspoken woman who has two children, and she is, I got to remember all the things I have to tell you. She's been divorced from a guy named Harpo, and he is mentioned here. And Harpo's father is just called Mr. Doesn't have a name until later in the novel, but what I'm going to read now, it's just Mr. So Sophia, now divorced from, or separated from Harpo, is with a guy they just call Prize Fighter. Sophia and the Prize Fighter are downtown, and they're both black. The mayor and his wife, both white, see Sophia and present her with an option that is unthinkable to her. And you can see that she is not going to be a fixed star in his world, and she is not going to be an immovable pillar, and the price she has to pay for that shakes not only her foundation, but ours as participants in the literature as well. The mayor and his wife are looking at Sophia's children. And this is told, by the way, we're being told this story through the voice and eyes of Celie, so she will say, she said, okay, just so you can follow how this, the logistics of this reading. All these children, say the mayor's wife, digging in her pocketbook, cute as little buttons though, she say. She stop, put her hand on one of the children's head, say, and such strong white teeth. Sophia and the prize fighter don't say nothing. They wait for her to pass. Mayor wait too, stand back and tap his foot. Watch her with a little smile. Now Millie, he say, always going on over the colored. Miss Millie, she fingered the children some more. Finally look at Sophia and the prize fighter. She look at the prize fighter's car. She eyes Sophia, wristwatch. She say to Sophia, all your children so clean. Would you like to work for me? Be my maid? Sophia say, hell no. She say, what you say? Sophia say, hell no. Mayor look at Sophia. Push his wife out of the way. Stick out his chest. Girl, what you say to Miss Millie? Sophia say, I say hell no. He slap her. I stopped telling it right there. This is the storyteller saying, I can't tell this anymore. I stopped telling it right there. Squeak on the edge of her seat, someone listening to this story. Squeak on the edge of her seat, she wait, look down my throat some more. No need to say more. Mister say, also listening to the story, you know what happened if somebody slapped Sophia. Again, well, Sophia is this tough woman, you don't mess with her. And squeak go white as a sheet. No, she didn't do that, she say.
Nah, nothing, I say. Sophia, knock the man down. The police has come, start slinging the children off the mayor, bang their heads together. Sophia really start to fight. They drag her to the ground. This is as far as I can go with the story. Looks like my eyes get full of water, my throat closed, and squeak, she's all these are the people listening to this about Sophia. Squeak, she all scrunched down in her chair, trembling. They beat Sophia, Mr. Say. What the prizefighter do in all this? I asked Sophia's sister. He wanted to jump in, but Sophia say, no, take the children home. Police have the guns on him anyway. One move, he dead. Six of them, you know, just one of him. Mister goes to plead with the sheriff to let us see Sophia, but he be in so much trouble, looks like so much like the sheriff and Mister are almost on family terms. The sheriff say, she's a crazy woman, your boy's wife there, you know that. Mister say, yes, sir, us do know it. Been trying to tell Harpo she crazy for 12 years, since way before they marry. Sophia come from crazy people. It's not all her fault. And then again, the sheriff, you know how women is anyhow. The sheriff think about how women the women he know, and he say, yep, you right, women crazy. Mister say, we gonna tell her she's crazy too, and maybe we can get her out. Sheriff say, well, make sure that you take care of her. Tell her that she's the lucky to be alive. And then they visit Sophia in the jail, and this is how the episode ends. When I see Sophia, I don't know why she's still alive. They crack her skull, they crack her ribs, they tear her nose loose on one side, they blind her in one eye, she's swole from head to foot. Her tongue the size of my arm, it stick out between her teeth like a piece of rubber. She can't talk, and she's just about the color of an eggplant. Scare me so bad I about near drop my grip, but I don't. I put it on the floor of the cell, take out my comb and brush, nightgown, witch hazel, and alcohol, and I start to work on her. The colored attendant bring me some water to wash her with, and I start at her two little slits, now swollen, slits of her eyes. Clear, no? And it's hard to follow, and I apologize for that, because it's a told story. Rather, I mean, there's somebody else listening to interjects and so on. But it's clear, isn't it? The upheaval in the universe is terrifying. What you say? You can't do that. And what's the price she has to pay? And then think about Baldwin's notion of the purpose of God is to make us larger, freer, more loving. Another wonderful book that is in the bookstore too, Their Eyes Are Watching God. And it's wonderful for lots of reasons. It's a great story, but the language is tremendous. It's full of metaphors that will open your mind to new ways to see things. For example, and I'll read that section, the black grandma tells her granddaughter that women, black women, are the mules of the world. And when that kind of metaphor makes you think of things in a very different way. And the book is full of those kinds of things. I'm not going to read this one, but for example, just to, I hope to entice you to read it and get a hold of the language will just take you away. The grandma is telling her life story to her granddaughter, who's being kind of sassy and doesn't want to do what grandma says. And grandma finally tells her about how her slave owner master took off for the Civil War and got about 10 feet, turned around, came back and raped her one more time before he left. And then she says at the end of her story, full of pathos, says, put me down easy, Janie, I'm a cracked plate. And the fragility of someone who's experienced, you know, the black experience in slavery. Well, the book is full of that, but I'd like to read some excerpts now quickly about, from Their Eyes Are Watching God, about the expectations of, in this special case, of the fixed star and the immovable pillar that women play in the lives, in the life of this book. So here we have one example. Come to your grandma, honey, and set in her lap like you used to. Your nanny won't harm a hair of your head, and she don't want nobody else to do it neither if she can help it. But you need to know, honey, the white man is the ruler of everything as far as I've been able to find out. Maybe it's someplace way off in the ocean where the black man is in power, but we don't know nothing about what we see, but what we see. So the white man throw down the load and tell the nigger man to pick it up. He pick it up because he have to, but he don't tote it. He hand it to his women folk. The nigger woman is the mule of the world as far as I can see, and I've been praying for it to be different with you. Lord, 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 I've been praying. you see it. Nanny, because she wants her granddaughter to have a different life, almost imposes a marriage upon her. It's with a man that's much older that Janie does not love. And this is why, and it's very short, why to Granny that she should love him. Janie, who's young and beautiful, has just said, "Nanny, I don't ever seem to want him." Well, if you don't want him, you show awe. He is, here he is, here are you, with the onlyest organ in town, play organ, amongst colored folks in your party. You got a house bought and paid for and 60 acres of land right there on the big road. What more can you want, child? The fixed star, the role is, be safe, be married. We understand that, and in the context of the novel, we understand that this is what Nanny, the raped by slavery and her master, this is what she wants, safety for her granddaughter. Well, that husband that she marries has one idea about women, and that is that your job is to stay in the kitchen and cook. But when I need you out in the field, you'll come out there. Well, another man comes along and says, "Holy cow, you are enslaved. Let me take you away and I'll bring you to it." And what he does is take her out of one kind of fixed star, one kind of immovable pillar, that is the woman is going to be in the kitchen, to another one. And you behind the plow, you ain't got no more business with a plow than a hog has with a holiday. You ain't got no business cutting up no seed taters neither. A pretty baby doll like you is made to sit on the front porch and rock and fan yourself and eat potatoes that other folks plant just special for you. Now what is she? She's that Barbie doll going to be sitting up there on the porch and I'm just going to take care of you. And that goes on. And this second marriage for her, the first one is the guy that makes her stay in the kitchen. The next one is that he becomes the mayor and his wife is this, well, here it is. Jenny loved to listen to the conversations out on the porch, and sometimes she thought up good stories herself, but Joe, her husband, had forbidden her to indulge. He didn't want her talking after such trashy people. "Use Mrs. Mayor Starks, Jenny. I can't see what a woman of your stability would want to be treasuring all that gum grease from folks that don't even own their own houses to sleep in. Tain't no earthly use. They's just some puny humans playing around the toes of time." Another fixed star for him. Another immovable pillar. And the narration calls that this marriage does this to Janie. The years took all the fight out of Janie's face. For a while, she thought it was gone from her soul. No matter what her husband did, she said nothing. She had learned how to talk some and leave some. She was a rut in the road. Plenty of life beneath the surface, but it was kept beaten down by the wheels. There's one of those wonderful metaphors again. Sometimes she struck out into the future, imagining her life different from what it was. But mostly, she lived between her hat and her heels with her emotional disturbances like shade patterns in the woods. Come and gone with the sun. She got nothing from Jody, that's her husband, except what money could buy, and she was giving away what she didn't value. Well, she takes him on, finally. And the straw that breaks the camel's back is she does work in the store that he owns, and he's the postmaster and the mayor, and he's really made it big in the town. And he sends her in to cut a plug of tobacco for a woman, and she makes a mistake and doesn't cut it the right size. And he scolds her, humiliates her in front of the whole town. "Oh, God almighty, a woman stay around the store till she get old as Methuselah and still can't cut a little thing like a plug of tobacco? Don't stand there rolling your Popeyes at me with your rump hanging nearly to your knees." A big laugh started off in the store, but people got to thinking and stopped. It was funny if you looked at it right quick, but it got pitiful if you thought about it a while. It was like somebody snatched off part of a woman's clothes while she wasn't looking and the streets were crowded. Then, too, Janie took the middle of the floor to talk right into Jody's face, and that was something that had never been done before. Now, and then I'll come back. You know, any upheaval in the universe is terrifying. As it turns out, I'll read this whole episode, but as it turns out, Jody gets sick and dies. He is so
emotionally and spiritually destroyed. His whole reality has been so shaken that he can't even live anymore, and he dies.
But this is what causes him to die. Remember, he talked about her rump hanging below. In other words, he's saying that you're getting old, and here it goes. Stop mixing up my doings with my looks, Jody. When you get through telling me how to cut a plug of tobacco, then you can tell me whether my behind is on straight or not. What? What's that you say, Janie? You must be out your head. No, I ain't out of my head either. You must be talking any such language as that. You the one started talking under people's clothes, not me. What's the matter with you, know-how? You ain't no young girl to be getting all insulted about your looks. You ain't no young courting gal. You's an old woman, nearly 40. Yeah. That hurts, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm nearly 40 and you's already 50. How come you can't talk about that sometimes instead of always pointing at me? Tain't no use in getting all mad, Janie. Because I mentioned you ain't no young gal no more. Nobody in here ain't looking for no wife out of you, old as you is. Nah, and I ain't no young gal no more, but then I ain't no old woman neither. I reckon I looks my age too, but I'm a woman every inch of me, and I know it. And that's a whole lot more than you can say. You big bellies around here and put out a lot of brag, but tain't nothing to it but your big voice. Huh, talk about me looking old. When you pull down your britches, you look like the change of life. Listen to the whole community's there now. Great God from Zion, Sam Watson gasped. You're really playing the dozens tonight. What? What's that you said? Jody challenged, hoping his ears had fooled him. I love this line. Walter, another guy listening, says, you heard her. You ain't blind. It's a fun book, besides poignant. Hud, another guy in the community, I'd rather be shot with tacks than to hear that about myself, Leeds Moss commiserated. And then Joe Starks realized all the meanings and his vanity bled like a flood. Janie had robbed him of his illusion of irresistible maleness that all men cherish, which was terrible, the thing that Saul's daughter had done to David. But Janie had done worse. She had cast down his empty armor before men, and they had laughed, and would keep on laughing. When he paraded his possessions thereafter, they would not consider the two together. They'd look with envy at the things and pity the man that owned them. When he sat in judgment, it would be the same way. Good-for-nothings like Dave and Lum and Jim wouldn't change place with him for anything. For what can excuse a man in the eyes of other men for a lack of strength? Joe Starks didn't know the words for all this pain in him, but he knew the feeling. So he struck Janie with all his might and drove her from the store. Just talk about that episode in this context or with this framework. The upheaval, the fixed star, the immovable pillar, and as he moves out of his, in this case it's a her, out of her place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. If we could list the roles, plural it is, or role, however we look at it, I guess, of women and of a black woman in a marriage, what is she supposed to be, according to what you just heard?
Submissive.
Submissive. My gosh! You know, no one in the community can believe it. Good. Good enough. We'll summarize it with that. Submissive. And so then what happens? The fixed star. And I guess I'm more interested in how would you, and well, whatever you want to talk about. But heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. How disturbing is this?
Very.
But Jody doesn't know what to do.
Have to do everything over.
Yeah. My whole self-image is gone. And I've got to read, and I don't even know how to react to that. So what do I do? The book is very complex, I think, and even in this little episode, we can look at some of the precipitators of violence. No, I don't know what to do. So,
in this case, I'm talking about women, the assumption is that they don't want to be submissive, But yet I see in conservative circles where women are becoming submissive within, let's say, I think of the evangelical movements. And I wonder why. This is maybe a separate
thing. I sure don't know why they haven't read The Rise of the Watching God. Might be wondering. It seems to be the case, though, doesn't it? That we see if we watch.
The Bible tells them so.
Yeah, good. The Bible, and you can pull anything out of that you want to find your fixed star, right? I mean, one of the fixed stars in the Bible, I love using this illustration, is that you can't wear nylon and wool together. And we're told, I mean, you can't do that. Or cotton wool. Two different kinds of cloth, anyway. And I love this one, too. When men are the first year of marriage, they can't be called to war, and they aren't supposed to go to work. Well, you know, who lives with that? So my point is, of course, those are silly fixed stars, but we've got a lot of fixed stars and some immovable pillars that aren't so silly. And one of those immovable pillars is, thou shalt not be gay and lead our church. Thou shalt not play guitars in our St. Paul Lutheran Church in Davenport, Iowa. Because we're shaken to the foundation. Well, this, and I guess this is what we want to get to, and now we'll go to that with the color purple. This is a sentence from Baldwin about the society, and as he applies it to race. That is, the black man has functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, but then when he moves out of his place, or in the case of The Rise of Watching God, she moves out of her place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. That parallels for Baldwin the role of the church as well, and how the church, that's what this quote is for. The purpose of God, the church, the purpose of God in the church, he could have said, is to make us larger, free, and we have that. Well, now we have something to pay attention to from the color purple. This is, again, the story of Sophia and Seely and Harpo. And so Seely, the narrator of the whole story, has a lot of immovable pillars and fixed stars in her life, and she is herself a fixed star. She's a woman who takes abuse, physical, sexual, verbal, all kinds of abuse. She's a woman who has no self-esteem at the beginning of the book, and this all changes. And one of the important precipitators of that change is a homosexual relationship that she has with a woman named Shug. And I think when I'm done with this episode, we'll try to list some of the things that Shug, in her relationship as she talks to Seely, shakes. Shug is going to shake up a lot of the fixed stars and the immovable pillars in Seely's eyes, and it wakens us all to the role of the church. She is talking with Shug. I don't write to God no more. I write to my sister. What happened to God? Asked Shug. Who that? I say. She look at me real serious. Big a devil as you is, Shug, I say, you're not worried about God, surely. She say, wait a minute. Hold on just a minute there. Just because I don't harass it like some people's us know, don't mean I ain't got no religion. What God do for me? I asked. She said to me, Seely, like she shocked. He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that love you to death. Yeah, I say, and he gave me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a step-pa, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow, I say, the God I've been praying and writing to is a man, and he acts just like all the other men's I know, trifling, forgetful, and low-down. Miss Seely, Shug say, you better hush. God might hear you. Let him hear me, I say. If he ever listened to poor colored women, the world would be a different place, I can tell you that. She talk and she talk, trying to budge me away from my blasphemy, but I blaspheme as much as I want to. All my life, say Shug, I never care what people thought about nothing I did. But deep, I'm sorry, this is Seely talking. All my life, I never care what people thought about what nothing I did. But deep in my heart, I care about God. What he going to think? And come to find out, he don't think. just sit up there glorifying and being death. But it ain't easy trying to do without God. Even if you know he ain't there, trying to do without him is a real strain. And Shug says, I is a sinner, because I was born. I don't deny it. I was a sinner because I was born. But once you find out what's out there waiting for us, what else can you be but a sinner? Sinners have more good times, I say. And you know why? She asked. Because you ain't all the time worried about God? Nah, that ain't it. We worry about God a lot. But once we feel loved by God, we do the best we can to please him with what we're like. You telling me God love you and you ain't never done nothing for him? I mean, like, go to church, sing in the choir, feed the preacher and all that. But if God loved me, Celie, I don't have to do all that. Unless I want to. There's a lot of other things I can do that I expect God likes. Like what? I asked. Oh, she said, I can lay back and just admire stuff. Be happy. Have a good time. Well, this sounded like blasphemy sure enough to me. She said, Celie, tell the truth. Have you ever found God? I love this line, listen. Have you ever found God in church? I never did. I just found a whole bunch of folks hoping for him to show. Any God I ever felt in church, I brought in with me. And I think all the other folks did too. They come to church to share God, not find God. Some folks didn't have him to share, I said. They the ones didn't even speak to me when I was there struggling with my big belly. She was pregnant by her father, she thought. They're the ones that didn't speak to me while I was there struggling with my big belly and Mister's children. Right, she say. And then she say, tell me what your God looked like, Celie. No, I say. I'm too ashamed. Nobody ever asked me this before. So I sort of took by surprise. And besides, when I think about it, it don't seem quite right. But it all I got. I decided to stick up for this God and just to see what Shug's saying. Okay, I say, he big and old and tall and gray-bearded and white. He wear white robes and go barefooted. Blue eyes, she asked. Sort of bluish gray, cool, big though. White lashes, I say. She laugh. Why you laugh, I asked. I don't think it's so funny. What you expect him to look like? My husband? There wouldn't be no improvement, she say. Then she tell me this old white man is the same God she used to see when she prayed. If you wait to find God in church, Celie, that's who's bound to show up, because that's where he live. Now, that's a complicated sentence, but everybody follow that? If you wait for God in church, you're gonna find this white old man with bare feet and white robes. Because that's where he live. How come, I asked? Because that's the one that's in the white folks' white Bible. Shug, I say, God wrote the Bible. White folks had nothing to do with it. Well, how come he looked just like them then, only bigger, and a heap more hair? How come the Bible, just like everything else they make, all about them doing one thing and another, and all the colored folks doing is getting cursed? I never thought about that. Nettie, that's her sister, Nettie says somewhere in the Bible it says that Jesus' hair was like lamb's wool. Well, said Shug, if he came to any of these churches we're talking about, he'd have to have it comped. Or straightened, right? Before anybody'd pay him any attention. The last thing niggers want to think about is the God that they have's got kinky hair. That's the truth, I say. There ain't no way to read the Bible and not think God white. I'm just gonna write that. White, I don't think she means looks. She means power and definition and values. So there ain't no way to read the Bible and not think God white, she say. Then she sigh. When I found out I thought God was white and a man, I lost interest. And you mad at your prayers? Huh. Did the mayor listen to anything colored folks say? Ask Sophia. That's the one that got beat up by the mayor. But I don't have to ask Sophia. I know white people never listen to colored, period. If they do, they only listen long enough to be able to tell you what to do. Here's the thing, say Shug, the thing I believe. God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. And sometimes it just manifests itself even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for many folks, I think. Sorrow, Lord, you know, feeling like shit. it. Remember, she said, you find it, she calls God. And Celie says, it? I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. What do it look like? I asked. Don't look like nothing, she say. It ain't a picture show. It ain't something you can look at apart from everything else, including yourself. I believe God is everywhere, everywhere. My first step from that old white man was trees, the creation, then air, then birds, and then other people. But one day when I was sitting quiet and feeling like a motherless child, which I was, it come to me, that feeling of being part of everything, not separate at all. I knew that if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed. And I laughed and I cried and I run all around the house. I knew just what it was. In fact, when it happened, you can't miss it. It's sort of like, you know what she say, grinning and rubbing high up on my Shug, I say. Oh, she say, God loves all your feelings. That's some of the best stuff God ever did. And you know, when God loves them, you enjoys them a lot more, and you just relax and go with life. God don't think sex is dirty? No, she say, God made it. Listen, God love everything you love and a mess of stuff you don't. But more than anything else, God love admiration. You saying God vain, loving himself? No, she say, not vain, wanting to share the creation. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. What do it do when it pissed off? I asked. Oh, it makes something else. People think and please God is all God care about, but any living fool in the world can see it's always trying to please us back. Yeah, I say. Yeah, she say. It, God, it always making little surprises and springing them on us when you least expect it. You mean it want to be loved, just like the Bible say? Yeah, Celie, she say. Everything want to be loved. We sing and dance and make faces and give flower bouquets trying to be loved. And you ever notice the trees do everything to get the attention that we do? Everything except walk. And then in the context of all her theology, and we can talk about that, it's not a perfect kind of thing. This is Alice Walker, structure and a character. But in all this theology and this new look, this radical look at God, she sets it up against social expectation. Man corrupt everything, say Shug. There are some literary critics who say that Alice Walker is talking about the male gender, that the male gender corrupts everything, and that's a valid criticism. But it's a limiting criticism, I believe. Man, I think, in a broader context, is human society. Society corrupts everything. It's not a single male, and that's plenty. There's plenty of that in this book, and males need to change. I mean, they're abusive and they're narrow-minded, but we've got, and here it is then, this society. Man corrupt everything, say Shug. He on your box of grits in your head and all over the radio. Remember the media stuff we've talked about, the computer stuff we've talked about for the week. He's on your box of grits in your head and all over the radio. He try to make you think he everywhere. And as soon as you think he everywhere, you think he God. But he ain't. Whenever you're trying to pray and man plop himself up on the other end of it, tell him to get lost. Conjure up flowers, wind, water, a big rock, love. But this is hard work, let me tell you. What do you get out of all that? And maybe the simplest way to start this is, what does man do, and what does God, in this illustration, do? And how do we mistake when man's there? You tell him, get lost, but this is hard work. My dad said, you can't go to church without a suit. It's hard work to imagine going in shorts. But it's more serious than that. He's on your grits, box of grits. Any concrete illustrations of that? I mean, some of them even literal.
Yeah, who's on the Wheaties box?
Yes, the Wheaties box. And who's on those Wheaties boxes?
Athletes.
Perfect bills. What?
Star
athletes. Beautiful bodies. Everything's perfect. Man, and you think you got to be that way, and if you're not that way, who's anorexic? Man's on your box of grits, and it's hard work to tell him to get lost. We have a very good friend who's anorexic, and boy, the struggles. Fight and fight and fight, because man's been on her box of grits for 24 years.
We get it right. Sugar's not so dumb.
What else?
Man, he's on your box. He's in the radio.
Well, the Wheaties man is also, or teen, or whatever, is always a winner. It's a winning.
Yeah, great example. Yeah, always a winner.
The little kid that comes home and throws his bag in the floor and says, we got beat today. I'm a loser. Great.
What else? We talked about it at the forum the other night. What if America's culture, sports culture, had a whole new idea about winning? Winning is every kid got to play. Woo! I mean, that's unthinkable to have something so radical.
What else, though?
Man,
what were the phrases? On your box of grits? In your head?
Just all the ideologies that you grow up with, society kind of banging you with everything. All their ideas. Whether you like it or not.
I just put you, I used your word ideology, social ideologies. What are some of those? We have to. We all have them. Women have. I mean, in this book and in these two books, written by women with vision about women's roles and about fighting those roles, about shaking their foundations. Ideologies for women. Kids. If you're a parent, when do your kids come to you most troubled? I mean, think of some examples.
When other kids say mean things.
When other kids say mean things, you're black, you get out of here. That little black kid in the all-white school. Sorry, I mean, an example I read a couple days ago in the class. The black kids are going to the carnival and the gatekeeper says, sorry, this party's for white kids. I'm a social ideology, I guess, to use your phrase. Well,
the comment somebody back here made, I took to mean the kind of images that come in advertising.
When what? Fire away.
Perfection.
Yeah. Images and symbols of our culture, what are they? I mean, all the images are white. Anybody my age, you grew up on TV, you didn't see a black person in a commercial. They didn't load their station wagon with lumber to build a porch. They didn't put groceries in the front seat. I mean, they just weren't there. You got some examples of that, though, images and symbols that...
Women are thin and beautiful.
Sure. Thin. What color's their hair?
Blonde. The Barbie doll.
Barbie doll figure. And there's one of the images, right? And Mom, I don't look like this. A powerful beginning. Read the beginning, it'll be enough. Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings starts off, I dream that I would wake up from this nightmare with blonde hair and blue eyes and not the space between my teeth which you can put in a number two pencil. I mean, she's 8 years old when she talks about that dream. I mean, she's 30 years old when she talks about the dream that she had when she was 8. Because I want to be thin and blonde and blue-eyed. Because I'm ugly. If anyone looks at the old Ebony magazine, you know that one? You know, kind of the what some people call the Black Life, because it's set up on the front page like Life magazine was. 1920s, 1930s, I've had students do the exercises. You can find all kinds of advertisements for what? Skin lighteners, hair straighteners. Richard Wright's Laud Today, not a very good novel, don't read it. I mean, go read Day of the Sun instead. His main character, for the opening scene, he wakes up with a nylon stocking and Vaseline over his head to flatten that kinky hair. Because he's not... Images and the symbols. Wrestle with this just for a second. Whenever you're trying to pray and man plop himself up on the other end of it, do we think of all these ideologies and the thing that you thought, the things that you said, the things that you thought of in your head, that these things, when they pop up, tell them to get lost. And so you're that little girl that's 14 and you're a little bit overweight and you have a space between your teeth and you are nappy, kinky hair. Tell them to get lost and conjure up, and then she says, love, flowers. But listen to this again. But this is hard work, let me tell you. Think about that little girl. How hard is it? Well, that's obvious. Let's wrestle with the tough stuff. Adults, What do we wrestle with in our church that prevents us so often, that become these fixed stars, these immovable pillars, prevents us from being, here's Baldwin's wonderful phrase, larger, freer, more loving?
Tradition.
What?
Tradition.
Yeah, and rattle some of those off.
I don't know.
Well, you always hear, we did it, we've always done it this way, we've did it. There's no change.
Yeah.
You don't want to.
Yeah, it was a hell of a fight to move from the red to the green hymnal, right? And then blue, with one voice, that's, you know, nature stuff, and to go further. Women pastors, they're coming. I mean, now the seminaries are more than 50% women, I think. But I remember our first intern that was a woman back in the 70s. Whoa. Can't do that.
And language for God.
For sure.
I think talking about the fixed star and the immovable pillar, when you change some of the language, it really does shake the heavens and the foundations for people, and it's an emotional, visceral thing. And I think that one of the ideologies is patriarchy, to see God as male rather than God as like no human.
Yeah.
And that we've sort of made that a literal, we've lost the sense of that, of father as analogy, as one of the metaphors for God.
Yeah.
Just think of God as literally male, like Seely does.
Yeah, good. And Shook says it, and Seely says what, it? And Holden Village said Abba Eba, and we said Abba, that's right?
Uh-huh.
And we said, what? And we've backed off, Holden Village has backed off. If you're comfortable saying this, when that first came out, as I remember, I'm not sure it was the year that my first year here, I don't remember. When that first came out, you didn't have an option, you said that. But if you're comfortable, because that's hard to do. It?
Yeah, right along those same lines, you know, in our churches, the issues that come up, like homosexuality or abortion, or, you know, you tackle anything, and it seems like we will go so far, you know, we'll inform the people, but we won't get into a situation where we can have some hard talk about it. And it's because fear of people leaving the church, I think.
Yeah. Have you had church meetings, congregational meetings, or some of the social statements ever? Mm-hmm. Our congregation did over the social statement on homosexuality, and we had them for three nights, one night for 3 weeks, and we stopped them. This was just too painful. And people, I mean, it's better to deal with, not deal with it, you know. That's, we lost two people in the church. One of the council persons that, you know, all the things that Seely said you should do, gave money, went to church, and sang in a choir, left because he couldn't. Wait, go ahead.
I just said a pillar. You lost
a pillar. Yeah, right. We lost a pillar.
And I was in Philadelphia for 3 years, and that was the first time that I really, as a Lutheran, worshiped with black people. Because where I've been, there really haven't been black people in the church. And the children in that church, the boys still came with suits and white shirts and ties, the black children. And I'll tell you, they followed every word of liturgy in the LBW. They weren't handed some peppermints or a pencil, paper to write on during the sermon. They behaved perfectly, those black children dressed up, and the boys that way. And then once I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, it was in 1967 when the church came out with a manifesto for the next century. The U.S. was 200 years old that year. And what were we going to do now? What could we do as a church? Do you remember a manifesto statement that came out then? And so in our church, they invited a husband and a wife who were black Lutherans to bring the sermon the morning that was to be inserted in the bulletin, the manifesto. And they came to our house for dinner afterwards, and with their son and with the wife's mother. And the young woman was just getting ready to move to Berkeley to go to attend seminary. She was an executive in the telephone company in Madison, Wisconsin. And after her 2 years of seminary, she was placed on internship with a black pastor in California. And she was treated so badly, she committed suicide that year.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Ooh. Thanks for sharing. Is it back to the first illustration of your all the little black kids not getting peppermints and wearing their suits and following the liturgy? Is that a, what do you think about that? That they did what they followed the tradition.
That you did.
That we did, yeah. Is the tradition, so that in that example, the tradition becomes, well, in the example for Shug, the tradition becomes man is all over your grits. This is how you will worship, and this is the only way to worship. You wear your suit, and they don't care if you're black or white. And if you come to our church and you wear your tie and follow the hymnal and without any help, good.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's an honoring of, we have to say we're diverse, and therefore what is life-giving and freeing and loving is going to be different for our different experiences. I mean, my ideologies are old tapes that keep God limited in, or anthropomorphic, or whatever my limitations are different than someone else. I mean, I worshiped in an all-black church last Sunday, and it's just different, and it is. Everyone's, I mean, they dress nice, we dress down. Maybe that's more freeing for us. Dressing for them says something else. The integration of who God is in the lives of some cultures, black and others, there's a different kind of integration even in how we live that out and are able to speak freely. I mean, so what is life-giving? Is going to be different to me. So it's hard to say. Maybe that's what works in that place.
Yeah, right, good. I have 4:45, so if you want to hang out and talk, I'll read a lot of more out of it. Your eyes wide from God. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy your day.
Thank you. Thank you.